You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, I'm Jody the mom.
And I'm Dr. Bar the doc, and this is Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with a special emphasis on homeopathy. We are delighted to have a guest today, my friend and colleague, Dr. Darren Ingles, who is going to talk to us all about Lyme and his own journey as well with Lyme. So he's got a lot of expertise in a lot of things. It was really hard to decide what to ask him to talk about, but you'll understand here pretty quickly why we asked him to talk to us about Lyme. So let me tell you a little bit about him before we get started. Dr. Ingles is a respected leader in natural medicine and with numerous publications, international lectures, and 30 years of experience in the healthcare field. He received his Bachelor of Science degree in medical technology from Purdue University and his Doctor of Naturopathic Medicine from Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Ingles completed his residency at the Bastyr Center for Natural Health. He is a licensed doctor of naturopathic medicine in the state of California, just up the road from me. He's a fellow with the American Academy of Environmental Medicine and a fellow with the Medical Academy of Pediatric Special Needs. Dr. Ingles has been published extensively and is the author of two books, one of which we're going to talk about today. So I'm really excited to welcome you, Dr. Ingles, to the podcast so we can talk a little bit more about Lyme, because this is the book that we're going to be talking about today, The Lyme Solution. You can see here, I got lots of, especially in the beginning part, because like you've got so many good resources back here. As a non-Lymey, I didn't need all of those exact resources, but I will tell you, I talked to my husband, who I think there's some possibilities because you've got a questionnaire in here that he definitely ticked the boxes for. I was happy to say I did not, so I'm pretty confirmed that I don't have to worry about it.
That's good.
But let's go ahead and just dive in. Welcome to the podcast. So excited to have you here. Yep.
Thank you both very much for having me. My pleasure to be here.
So you dedicate your book to your fellow Lymies. Can you tell us about your experience with Lyme disease?
Sure. I lived in Connecticut. After finishing residency in Seattle, I took a job in Connecticut. And for people who don't know, Lyme disease is actually named after Lyme, Connecticut. They discovered back in the late 70s, a large group of children were having unexplained arthritic symptoms. And it took them several years to figure it out. But they finally figured out that there was a bacteria, particularly one called a spirochete. And a doctor named Willie Bergdorfer, he was a researcher for the government, who discovered this sort of unknown spirochete. So the rule is, if you discover it, you get to name it after yourself. So it was called Borrelia bergdorferi, named after Willie Bergdorfer. And so, yeah, I moved to Connecticut and had been joined a practice there. And I was there for about a little over a year, and then decided to venture out on my own, start my own practice. And 2 weeks before I was set to open my doors, I got Lyme disease. And I had every classic textbook symptom you may have heard or read about. I had the big bullseye rash on the back of my leg. I had 105 fever, joint pain, neuropathy, throbbing, pounding headache, and just the whole gamut of symptoms. And I got treated right away. And within a handful of days, all my symptoms went away. And I figured that was the end of that. But for anyone who's ever owned their own business, you know what it's like when you get started. I didn't have staff. I was doing everything myself and working 6-7 days a week, 10, 12, 14 hour days. Mm-hmm. And 8 months into that schedule, I relapsed and I started having symptoms again. So I said, okay, well, I treated it before. I'll treat it again. I know what to do. And I was treated with doxycycline initially for 3 weeks. So I went back on doxycycline. It didn't do anything for a month. Then I switched to azithromycin, did that for another month, didn't do anything. At that point, I started working with a local Lyme doctor because I was still new to Lyme disease, being relatively new to Connecticut. And I started on just a myriad of oral combination antibiotics. And over the course of 9 months, just got worse. My symptoms worse. My gut was a wreck. I lost 30 pounds in 6 months unintentionally. And I had known of a doctor in New York City named Dr. Zhang. He's a Chinese medical doctor and acupuncturist. And I went to see him and he started me on Chinese herbs and also was a reminder that, you know, you're not taking very good care of yourself. You need to sleep once in a while and you probably should eat better food. Mm-hmm. And after that wake up call and starting the herbs, within a month, I felt 80% better. Mm-hmm. So from there on out, it still took me another, I'll say two and a half years to feel like I got to a point where I was really 100% symptom free, but got to that point. And you'll appreciate this. The magic, I mean, I took herbs, I did all these things. I'll say I was 90% better. I had that 10% I couldn't shake. And I was fortunate to have trained with a great homeopath out of Belgium, Henny Hoedensmast. And Henny used to come to the United States and do case taking with other doctors. And someone didn't show up one day, so I volunteered myself to be a patient. And she gave me homeopathic Apis 200C, and it got rid of all my symptoms. Fantastic. So I credit homeopathy for being the final straw in my healing journey to get well. And then really, I just started applying what I did for myself to all my Lyme patients. And of course, once the word gets out, you know, when a doctor has a disease or condition, you know, people come to see you for it. So very quickly, my practice became very Lyme centric. I'd already been working with a lot of children with autism prior to that. So, you know, as my practice kind of evolved over time, you know, it still centers a lot around Lyme disease, children, special needs. And of course, Lyme can be a major, major trigger for PANS. Yep. So I just said, I just really kind of applied what I did for myself to my patients and found that they got better faster.
Yeah. You know, I did notice that you attributed your final full recovery to homeopathy in your book. So I was very excited to see that. And I can't wait to talk to you more about that in a little bit. But we really want to dive into helping people understand when Lyme is part of their condition and some of the things they might need to take into consideration and some of the treatments that might be recommended. Because a lot of people, like, well, you at least had experience and familiarity with homeopathy before. Many people will get to the place that you're talking about that you reached, which was like 80 to 90% better, right, doing all the dietary, medical interventions, herbs, supplements, you name it, but just don't get over that finish line. And if they let anything slip at all, they see their symptoms start to flood back. And I totally agree. Like, as soon as somebody realizes that you have that condition, it helps you connect with people so much more. That's why Jody came to see me. And that's why so many people connect with me, because I likely had PANS as a child. So, all right. So in pandas and PANS, many people, well, pandas specifically, you know, a strep, many people don't have any symptoms of strep other than those neuropsychiatric symptoms. I mean, sometimes they never have any like sore throat or fever or anything. And it right. can make it really hard to diagnose for some people. So we know that Lyme is a big contributor to PANS, like you mentioned. And in your book, so I guess I showed people. So for people who are just listening on audio on Spotify, it's called The Lyme Solution, a 5-part plan to fight the inflammatory autoimmune response and beat Lyme disease by Dr. Darren Ingles. We'll put a link to it in our show notes for anybody who wants to check this out. So in your book, you talk about how Lyme can really go undetected for years.
Right.
Is that similar to where strep in pandas, where symptoms are present, but not obviously related to strep for those that are unfamiliar? Or is it like really, truly no symptoms?
Well, they call Lyme the great imitator, the great mimic. It looks like a lot of different things. There's over 100 symptoms associated with Lyme disease. And because Lyme can affect any tissue, any organ, we see a broad spectrum of how it manifests in people. There's the classic Lyme disease. And to be honest, I mean, I've treated over 8,000 Lyme patients in my career now. I've seen just a handful that have what we would consider classic Lyme disease. Yeah. More often, people have this myriad of unexplained symptoms that go on for months to years. They've been to the doctor, they've been to the specialist, they've done the blood test, the MRI, and it's just nothing, 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 nothing. So it takes a little bit of detective work. We run into a problem with testing in that the blood tests that are available are antibody tests. We're not measuring the organism directly. And unfortunately, we don't really have the technology yet that we can measure Lyme directly in your body. So we're looking at the immune response. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the research of the standard tests that, you know, Quest and LabCorp and these kind of labs run, it's only about 43% sensitive, which means it literally misses more than half of the people that have Lyme disease.
Yeah.
And that, at best, that test would be good if your exposure was recent being probably within a matter of weeks. The further you get away from that exposure, we know that immunity wanes with time. So if your exposure was 6 months, 2 years, 5 years ago, the likelihood of picking it up on an antibody test goes way down. And unfortunately, the CDC criteria for calling this test positive, I guess I should backtrack. You know, this test was never designed to be diagnostic. It was designed as a surveillance tool for people that had classic Lyme disease. So to this day, if you go to the CDC's website and you read about Lyme disease, the diagnosis is clinical. It's based on your signs and symptoms, and particularly if you live in an area that's endemic for ticks. So for people who don't know, Lyme disease is mostly spread through deer ticks. And deer ticks are found heavily up on the east and western seaboards of the United States, some in the central part of the United States, particularly the upper Midwest. But really, Lyme has been reported in all 50 states. So this idea that you live in Texas, you live in Arizona, where we don't really think about deer ticks, it doesn't exclude the possibility of having Lyme. And of course, people travel and they may pick it up somewhere, not necessarily where they live. So the diagnosis is tricky. You know, a negative test doesn't exclude the possibility of having Lyme disease. So really, we look at the collection of symptoms. We do the blood test anyway, and some labs are better than others. There are some labs like Igenex. There's one called Medical Diagnostic Labs that have better test kits that are more likely to pick it up. So those of us in the field tend to use these labs rather than a regular reference lab. But even if you get a positive with Quest or LabCorp, there really are very few false positives. False negatives are very common. False positives are not. So again, if a test comes back positive, all that tells us is you've had exposure. It doesn't tell me you have Lyme disease. I'm sure if I tested everybody up in New England, I bet you 70% of people, some of them would have antibodies against Lyme. They don't all have Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. So the exposure just tells us that you've made an immune response to the organism. Now, theoretically, you could get bit by a tick that carries Lyme. If your immune system's healthy and robust, you make the robust, you know, antibody response. Your body controls the organism before you really ever become symptomatic. And that could be the end of that. But if I do a blood test, I'll see evidence of that exposure. So we can't use the blood test by itself to say you have Lyme disease. But if you have the clinical features, you've got a positive blood test, and you've ruled out other possibilities, you know, then we kind of put all the pieces together, and you know, that's how we come up with a diagnosis of Lyme.
You know, it's so interesting because you've mentioned that there's hundreds of symptoms, right, that you could get that could be related to Lyme. So it's almost hard. Like I'm not even going to ask you to list them because you've got them in as a great resource in your book that you can check through the questionnaire to see if it's possible. And you can just look them up to see if it's possible that it would come up. But I love that you bring up what we talk about almost every time we meet on this podcast is this concept of susceptibility, because ultimately, you know, with pans and pandas, strep isn't the cause of pandas. It's just a trigger for somebody who's susceptible to having that reaction. And there's this belief for so many people in our community that Lyme is a be-all end-all. If you get bitten by a tick that has Lyme, you will get Lyme and you must take antibiotics. And you just basically said that that's not true. It depends on your susceptibility to getting Lyme and to having an immune system that is susceptible to not being able to fight it off. And so that's a really important component. I just want to make sure we don't brush over that.
Yeah, I should mention, I mean, again, you're right. There's a lot of symptoms that are common with Lyme disease, but the red flags for me is when you see a combination of psychiatric symptoms and arthritic symptoms, that narrows the field down quite a bit. There are very few things that cause both. And, you know, we're talking about Lyme disease, but I should qualify that there are other infectious agents that ticks carry that aren't Lyme disease. There's things like Bartonella and Babesia and Anaplasma and Rickettsia and Mycoplasma. I mean, I swear every time I go to a Lyme conference, we've learned another 20 things that ticks carry that now we got to test for. And any one of these can be potential triggers, particularly for PANS. You know, it's interesting, you know, when I first learned about PANS, I'm sure, you know, we all got kind of drilled that it was strep. And we've now since learned that really any number of organisms can trigger it. I will argue that Lyme is a bigger trigger than strep.
I agree. That's
been my clinical experience in that Lyme and really even other factors are bigger triggers for strep. Yeah. I'll just share a quick story because I think it's relevant. I had a patient I was working with in Connecticut. He was 8 years old at the time. And he had classic PANS symptoms, really overnight, tics, OCD, anxiety, the whole gamut. And so we tested him and I did a blood test and his strep titer was sky high. I'm like, perfect. Okay, this is classic pandas or PANS, right? It's strep induced. And I started treating him for strep and he got a little better, but it wasn't significant. And mom finally says, well, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, he had Lyme disease, but he was treated and I think he was fine. And then when we targeted Lyme, One of the things we did called LDI or low dose immunotherapy, which is an immune modulating therapy. It's basically homeopathic Lyme. Mm-hmm. It's a nosotherapy. I gave him a dose and 24 hours later, all his symptoms completely went away. Mm-hmm. So what I realized is that the strep was the catalyst. It wasn't the cause. It was the thing that somehow disrupted his immune system to the point where now he started having more of this autoimmune reaction from Lyme that was probably just lurking in the background. Yeah. And I think we see that with a lot of these microbes. You know, PANS can be caused by any number of different bugs, and many of which are part of you. They're part of your normal flora. They're not true pathogens. In fact, almost all of it is not true pathogen. So what is it about the terrain that has allowed your immune system to not have immune tolerance to these organisms that then triggers PANS and this, you know, variety of other symptoms?
Yeah.
What about acute Lyme? How often does that turn into chronic Lyme, and how long does that take?
It's a great question. So the CDC, the Infectious Disease Society of America, will tell you chronic Lyme doesn't exist. What they call it is post-Lyme treatment syndrome, which means we don't know what it is, but you've already been treated for Lyme, so it's not Lyme disease. You just got something else. What's crazy, though, is that we've got research that shows that up to 20% of the Borrelia organisms, even from the moment you get bit by a tick, are what are called persister cells. And what that means is that they're already resistant to antibiotics from the get-go. So if you can only eradicate 80% of the organisms, you got 20% left over that persist and continue either to trigger your immune system, causing autoimmune issues, or just cause active infection elsewhere in the body. Yet despite this research, you know, the government and the big, you know, three-letter agencies all kind of ignore these facts. So we get into a bit of a political dilemma with, you know, with government agencies, with insurance companies, about getting proper treatment. This idea that you just treat for 2 or 3 weeks with doxycycline, for those of us in the know that for the majority of people, for a lot of people, that's not adequate. It's not enough. And here's the other crazy thing. You know, the treatment recommendation is 14 to 21 days, typically of doxycycline or perhaps amoxicillin if you don't tolerate doxycycline or your young child. The life cycle of the Lyme organism is incredibly slow. Most bacteria in your body replicate every 10 to 20 minutes. So when you get strep throat, you can take Zithromax or Z-Pak for, you know, 5 to 7 days, and that takes care of it because the best time to kill any bacteria is when it's in a replication phase. Mm-hmm. And these antibiotics do that. And same thing if you get bronchitis or sinusitis, which is why 7 to 14 days is pretty typical. It's enough time that you kill enough of the organisms and certainly enough time to give your immune system to take care of the rest. Well, if you get tuberculosis, TB, which fortunately we don't see much in our country anymore, but it's still out there, they will put you on a triple antibiotic cocktail for 9 to 12 months.
Yeah.
Heavy duty, because tuberculosis is a slow-growing organism. Well, what's slow-growing? It's every 15 to 20 hours. So mm-hmm. relative to every 10 to 20 minutes, that's very slow. Yeah. If you look at the replication cycle of Lyme, it's every 1 to 16 days.
Right.
So why are we content to give Lyme patients 2 to 3 weeks of antibiotics, where we'll give TB patients 3 antibiotics for up to a year, and it isn't even as slow-growing as Lyme?
Yeah. So what I'm hearing from you, like, the reality is that even if you take antibiotics, if you catch it quickly and you catch it early, that because there's 20% of the cells are already antibiotic resistant persister cells, and that we're not going to have enough time to actually stop the replication of everything as it's existing in your body and doing its thing, that the reality is that you could treat acute Lyme and still get chronic Lyme.
It's possible.
Yeah.
And we know from, again, the research that that same number, about 20% of people do go on to have persistent symptoms. Again, yeah. The government doesn't call it chronic Lyme disease. Those of us in the world do. And based on the research and our clinical experience, because the symptoms are often the same, the things that people get, even in their acute illness, the joint pain, the headaches, the brain fog, the fatigue, the insomnia, the mood changes, they had that when they had acute Lyme, and these symptoms have persisted. So it's not like it's a different syndrome that drastically changes after people have been treated. So again, I don't really understand the disconnect of why there's so much resistance to calling it what it is.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, that's kind of where things are at in the political landscape.
Right.
It makes it so frustrating for us moms because we do our research and we communicate with each other. So we know these things, but then whenever we try to seek treatment for our kids, it's just so frustrating to get met with that. Are there certain risk factors for being susceptible to chronic Lyme?
I think the risk factors are probably the same as getting any chronic infection. You know, anything that suppresses your immune system, anything that's altered your immune system, potentially puts people at risk. I think diet, gut health are critically important. And we could probably just say the same thing for PANS, right? You know, you got a kid with a terrible gut and a bad diet, that puts them at risk. There's very little research out there in the Lyme world that kind of elucidates that. But based on my clinical experience, you know, it's the people who have some element of immune alteration that tend to be the ones that end up with these persistent symptoms.
And I just want to acknowledge that there's plenty of people that we see as well, at least in our community, that have like the perfect diet, the perfect, you know, everything, and they still end up with PANS. So if you happen to be one of those people who is hearing this and you're like, but I still have PANS, like, you're not alone. There's a lot of people who have very clean, very healthy lifestyles and still end up with PANS because they have that susceptibility.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if there is a unique presentation that you see for kids who have PANS with Lyme as a trigger versus some of the other triggers that are common for PANS.
Well, in terms of PANS, I don't know that, I think the one thing that may be more unique about Lyme when it's related to PANS is when I start seeing a lot of arthritic symptoms.
Yeah.
Because a lot of kids with strep, they'll get the classic PANS. They won't necessarily get the arthritic things. They won't complain of joint pain. And, you know, even for young kids that may not be able to express it, parents will see it in the way they walk and the way they move, the way they behave. You know, when kids are in pain, in some way, it's usually expressed. Either you visually see it or they'll moan, they'll cry. There'll be some cue that something isn't quite right. So again, you know, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is an arthritic condition of children, is very rare. Mm-hmm. So the likelihood of it being that's pretty small. But if you've got a kid with PANS and you notice that they're having joint issues or you actually see inflamed joints, that would make me highly suspicious of Lyme. But a lot of the other symptoms are kind of vague. Again, kids that are chronically tired. Again, a lot of kids I see with PANS that's not Lyme, they're not necessarily tired. In fact, often they have the opposite problem. They're very hyperactive. A lot of Lyme kids will have more fatigue. They'll want to sleep more. They'll want to nap more. They'll have the arthritic symptoms. And they might have other weird neurological things that aren't necessarily associated with PANS. If they complain about numbness and tingling and creepy crawlies under their skin, burning sensation, almost feel like you have a secondary sunburn, that would suggest to me that there might be Lyme as part of the problem.
Yeah.
What about, is it possible for someone diagnosed with ASD to actually have Lyme instead?
So about 30% of the children I see with autism have Lyme disease. I treat their Lyme. I see a lot of symptoms get better. Language improves, sleep improves, the behavior improves, they're better eye contact, more engaged. But I've never seen a child be treated for Lyme and their autism went away.
Fair enough. There's just a lot of overlap between PANS and autism. So we wanted to make sure that we address that with you because I'm sure that somebody's got that question.
Yeah, it's very easy for parents just to chalk up everything that their child experiences. Oh, it's just autism. It's just autism. But, you know, autism is very much a medical problem. So you've got to go through and figure out where those medical blocks are. Yeah. And underlying infection, whether it's Lyme or something else, again, is very, very common.
So you've talked to us earlier about some of the tests that are good, not so good, and some alternative tests. I'm curious if there are any standard lab tests that might be suggestive that somebody has Lyme, even with like antibodies or a Western blot being negative. So,
yeah, there's really no biomarker that I've ever seen that's consistent that suggests Lyme. You know, even a lot of the inflammatory markers, CRP, sed rate, things that a lot of doctors run routinely. You know, most Lyme patients on paper look great. You know, they don't necessarily have anything that stands out. So unless you've done a Lyme test to suggest you might have had exposure, blood count, metabolic panel, autoantibodies, a lot of these tests usually can look normal.
Okay.
And how does your own immune system play a role in fighting Lyme?
Well, your immune system, like really for any infection is designed to recognize what's part of you, what's not part of you. So Borrelia is not part of your normal internal microbiome. So when you have that exposure, it generally will recognize it like, hey, you don't belong here. And it will activate to eradicate the organism. You know, what we find is that Lyme in the research can actually trigger a cross reaction to very specific parts of your body, particularly your gray and white matter of your brain. We know it cross reacts with your peripheral nerves and your joints. So a lot of these symptoms we see with Lyme is it may very well be due really more to an autoimmune reaction than actual infection in getting into that tissue area. And I would argue that most people with chronic Lyme is really more of an autoimmune problem than the direct infection. Because I see so many people that have been through, I mean, months or years of treatment with antibiotics and herbs and different things. And if it was really just a straight infection problem, you've taken enough stuff to kill a horse. You know, it should have eradicated the infection at that point. But if you're still having symptoms, you know, even if there's a small number of, like I said, persister cells, it could be enough to aggravate your immune system. And then you end up with this perpetual autoimmune reaction that can be equally as damaging and, you know, causing symptoms.
So you mentioned in the book, and then the CDC shares that, like, you need to start the antibiotics within that 72-hour window when you first notice the tick or notice the rash, right? Is there benefit to using antibiotics if you start it outside of that 72-hour window?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the sooner you start, the better. We have some patients that, you know, we see, as far as we can tell, their exposure was in the last several weeks. I think if you can catch it in the first, you know, maybe 6 to 8 weeks of exposure, you know, there's a chance that antibiotics can work. You know, the conversation I have with my patients is, you know, we have antibiotics as an option. And although I generally don't prefer to use antibiotics, this is a case where I think, you know, it's probably warranted. Yeah. But, you know, I have a lot of patients that choose to use herbs. Mm-hmm. Out of the 8,000 Lyme patients, I've probably written 10 prescriptions for antibiotics. So I have complete faith in herbs and what they do. And I think the beauty of herbs, too, is that not only do they target the organism, because there's so many other chemical constituents in herbs, you know, they're anti-inflammatory. They promote better circulation. They help boost your immune system. So we get 2 or 3, 4 actions of one herb, where an antibiotic is really just designed to target the bug and kill it. With herbs, we can target the bug without disrupting your gut microbiome in the same way and get all these other benefits. So we can really mix and match different herbs for each person so that we really accomplish all the goals we're trying to achieve for the individual. So, you know, I always hate to use the word protocol because mm-hmm. protocol suggests there's just a one size fits all for everyone. And with Lyme, much like PANS, you know, everyone's very unique in the way it presents and what they react to. So we've got to find for the individual what works best for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what about when someone's dealing with Lyme and co-infections? Are there signs and symptoms that help differentiate between the two?
In some cases, yes. We know if you have Babesia can cause this throbbing, pounding migraine. Lyme can do it too, but Babesia tends to be worse. People with Babesia will often get cyclical fever, where they get fever, they go back down, get fever, go back down. This happens every handful of days. They can also experience something called air hunger, where it's not asthma. You do all your pulmonary function test or a pulse oximeter. You're getting enough oxygen, and it's just a feeling that you're not getting enough oxygen. You'll see the people just wanting to, you know, get that deep breath. So that's kind of common with Babesia. Bartonella can cause these, they look like stretch marks, and they occur often in the torso, the hips, and the buttock area. That has nothing to do with weight changes. And particularly when I see this in kiddos that have these, you know, purple streaks, and often they're perpendicular to the natural folds of your skin. That's almost, you know, telltale sign of Bartonella. A lot of people with Bartonella will complain of a burning sensation, a burning kind of neuropathy, where often with Lyme, it's just more numbness and tingling. And people with Bartonella often complain of feet pain. It's like they go to stand, they go to walk, and they feel like they're walking on glass. That's a little bit more unique to Bartonella. Other infections, you know, like Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, although the signs and symptoms aren't as differentiated. When you do a blood count, both of those can cause your white blood count to drop a lot. So if we see that your white count's dropping, that can be a sign. So there are a few things on some of the infections that kind of delineate, but there's a tremendous amount of overlap between them, which is why when someone comes in, you know, we're usually testing for the battery of at least common infections: Lyme, Bartonella, Babesia, Anaplasma, Mycoplasma. These are probably the most common, sometimes Rickettsia. And then sometimes we'll do a second level of testing if that all kind of comes back negative, looking at the more obscure tick-borne illnesses.
So people who are listening to this who are utilizing homeopathy or learned a lot about homeopathy through our previous episodes might be curious why Jody and I are getting into so much detail about like these differentiating things, because ultimately the diagnosis doesn't matter per se. Like, you're not going to give this particular remedy because you've got this particular infection. It's based off of how your body responds to that infection and your particular susceptibilities. Yeah. That said, the diagnosis can make a difference for management. And so this is where it really is helpful to understand, like, you know, if it's a Lyme case, it tends to be a little bit more sticky, and like the reactions and responses to remedies are a little bit more subtle and progressive rather than big jumps, big improvements and big drop-offs and big improvements and big drop-offs. And so knowing how to expect, what to expect and how to manage it makes a difference. And knowing these subtle differences can help, at least giving some insight whether or not somebody follows through with testing, if they're using homeopathy as their primary method of treatment. So I've got one more like really, really nitty gritty question, because I'm sure, again, anybody who's read your book or who's done a deep dive into Lyme, which, you know, Pan's parents do deep dives into everything. You shared that there are different species of Lyme based off of like what coast you're on. You talked about that earlier, like there's the West Coast and then the East Coast. And I'm just curious if that even gives a different presentation. So like if somebody's on the West Coast, do they need to be looking at different symptoms versus if somebody's on the East Coast?
That's a great question. And there are differences amongst Borrelia species. However, it tends to be more by continent than mm-hmm. from East Coast to West Coast. So within North America, the presentation can look very similar. The dominant species is Borrelia burgdorferi, and that's true for most of North America. We now know that about half the cases in California are Borrelia miyamotoi, a different mm-hmm. strain. So understand, again, the test that you're doing through a conventional lab is only looking at Borrelia burgdorferi. So if you happen to have been exposed to a strain that's not that, again, the likelihood of picking it up on a blood test goes down. If you acquired it while traveling to Europe, well, that's primarily Borrelia afzelii and Borrelia guarinii. They're completely mm-hmm. different species. And if you go to Asia, it's something different. So this has been kind of the, again, confounding problem, is that when we learned about Lyme, because it came from Connecticut, everyone in the world based it off a North American strain.
Yeah.
You know, Australia says there's no Lyme in Australia, but they've all been testing for Borrelia burgdorferi. I'm like, well, of course you don't have Borrelia burgdorferi in Australia because you're Australia. And it's not that the ticks can't swim that far. It's just that they're probably looking for the wrong bug.
Right.
And so for the poor people living in Australia, they get little to no help because the government says Lyme doesn't exist.
Right. Well, let's shift gears just a little bit, because we've talked a lot about how to identify and what it looks like. Your book has so much good information about treatment options for people and gives a lot of really good guidance and specifics. So let's shift gears and talk about that for just a little bit.
Sure. Well, you know, the way I wrote the book, of course, as I said, you know, there's no protocol, but when you write a book, you know, you're trying to appeal to as many people as you possibly mm-hmm. can. But I think the foundational things are the same. You know, we always start with, you know, gut and diet. If your gut's a mess, since up to 80% of your immune system stems from the gut, if you've got chronic constipation, diarrhea, gas, bloating, you know, whatever it is, SIBO, all of that is going to interfere with everything that follows downstream. So we've always got to make sure that you're eliminating well, that you're digesting your food, you're absorbing your food. And then, of course, what you put in your mouth matters. I mean, I have a lot of kids with PANS, you know, that even by making dietary changes, we can see a reduction in symptoms because we've taken some of that burden off the immune system, that it's not so reactive, not so hypersensitive. So gut and diet are always number one. And then the next part is really targeting the organism. And again, in my book, I talk through, there's so many different herbs. I tell my patients, I'm like, look, we have plan A, B, C, D, E, F, and G if we need it. We just need a place to start. And there's really no right or wrong way. You know, for kids in particular, I generally like to use tinctures. just because we can drop dose these herbs and find out very specifically what each child needs. And I'm always amazed that sometimes, you know, one drop a day, one drop twice a day of one or two herbs is enough that it controls their symptoms, that they get a lot better. I've got a child I'm working with in LA now with, you know, pretty significant PANS. And for him, it's a lot of ticks. And we found out he had Lyme, and he was only on two or three drops a day of cat's claw, and it greatly reduced his symptoms. And now I just talked to mom a couple of weeks ago, and she's like, it's a rare tick. They're almost completely gone. So you don't necessarily have to give a lot to get the clinical benefit. And I hear this argument often from people who don't really know. They're like, well, if I'm not doing antibiotics, you know, the same thing happens with PANS. If you're not doing antibiotics, you're not really treating it. I'm like, well, but often you're treating one problem for another. You know, you can't kill the bad stuff without killing the good stuff. And there's going to be collateral damage with antibiotics. And how much do we depend on our gut microbiome to control our immune system? And so in the effort to get some of these symptoms under control, are we now just creating a secondary problem because of the antibiotics? So yeah. I'm certainly not in the camp that you have to use antibiotics. Again, acute Lyme disease, that may be appropriate, but for anything that's persistent, the evidence is such that antibiotics may only work while you're on them, and then they stop once you're off, or they don't work really well at all. And I've seen people cycle through years of antibiotics. They have no clinical improvement. Again, their gut's a mess. They have all these other side effects from the antibiotic. At what point do you draw a line in the sand and go, this isn't really the right approach? So I think herbs can be very, you know, targeted in that way.
Well, and the reality is, like we said before, your immune system plays a huge role, and the health of your immune system and your susceptibility matters as well. So to say that if you aren't using an antibiotic to treat it, then you're not really treating it, is completely disregarding all of the things, the important ways that our immune system plays a role, and that not everybody who has exposure to Lyme is going to get Lyme. So,
well, there's enough people out there, I think, and social media influencers that leave people with the impression that, again, if you're not treating with antibiotics, you're not really treating. And again, I know a lot of Lyme doctors that are of that opinion. Yeah. Most of them, of course, are medical doctors. Their training is different than you and I. You know, we're trained in herbs. We understand them. They, as a whole, don't really understand them, but that's neither here nor there. But again, I think, you know, you can very easily put together a, you know, a handful of herbs, again, to target the organism, get inflammation under control, help all these other aspects of someone's health with little, very few to any side effects. So beyond that, you know, I think the next step is, you know, you have to look at your environment. You have to look at toxicity. I think cellular toxicity is the root of most, if not all, chronic illnesses. So if it's mold toxins, and I find a large number of my Lyme patients also have mold illness. You know, they live in water damaged buildings. They've had that exposure. Kids in school, a lot of schools are terrible with having mold issues. Mm-hmm. But it could be pesticides. It could be herbicides. It's the Glade plug-in that someone puts in their house. It's the detergents you use. It's the soaps, the shampoos, all that. So just taking stock of what's in and around the home. And again, this is the low-hanging fruit that anyone can do. Doesn't break the budget. You can choose to use a more natural product versus a toxic product. Get the load down the body. That just helps reduce what's coming into the system. You know, your body's got a built-in mechanism to detoxify, but if you just keep constantly overloading it with junk, it's hard sometimes for the immune system to keep up. And I would argue that most people with chronic disease are not great detoxifiers. I think that's part of why they end up where they're at. So anything can do to lower that load's great. And then really the last part for me is all these other lifestyle factors. You know, are you sleeping well? So many people with chronic illness don't sleep well because they're uncomfortable. There's something that interferes. But if you think about what happens when you get deep sleep, that's when your body detoxifies. That's when tissue repairs itself. It's when your brain detoxifies. Yeah. So the more you miss of that deep restorative sleep, it's just harder for Mother Nature to do what it's designed to do and heal your body. And, you know, getting good movement, you know, it's easy when you're not feeling well to do nothing. But we know that when you move your body, you're moving the blood, you're moving the lymph, which is important for detoxification. I think it's good for our mental well-being to get out and get some fresh air and hopefully sunshine if you live in a climate that warrants that. And even for people that are disabled to any number of different degrees, there's something you can do. If you're in a wheelchair, there's something you can do. If you can barely move. I mean, when I first had Lyme disease, I could barely move. I was so tired. And I was an athlete most of my life. I can remember just plunking in front of the couch and stretching. That's all I could muster up. And then I started doing a couple of laps around the house and then a couple of laps around the neighborhood. And I eventually got to a point where I started studying martial arts and I got a black belt in karate. So, you know, it took time, but, you know, you just got to kind of keep pushing your body to what you can tolerate, but some movements better than other. And then just the mental part of this, you know, it's being sick, having a chronic illness. It's mentally taxing as the patient or as the caregiver. And so having avenues to deal with that mental, emotional stress and trauma, you know, that gets into a whole different ball of wax. And I do not consider myself a trauma specialist at all, but I recognize that for a lot of people, this is another limiting factor for people, why they don't get well. There's some unresolved either childhood trauma or adult trauma. And we talk about trauma, it could be big T, it could be little T. It doesn't have to be the horrible things. Sometimes it's, you know, the kid that made fun of your jacket in the third grade or the kid that pushed you on the playground that, you know, you got to realize as an adult, your child brain perceives things different than your adult brain.
Yeah.
And those things that happen early in life can have a different impact, and we can rationalize it now as an adult and go, oh, it wasn't really a big deal. But having an avenue to start dealing with some of that can be incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
So I am curious if you would share with us mamas what we could have at home in our medicine kit. I know that you had mentioned a couple of things in your book, the tweezers with the magnifying glass and the herb cobas. What are some other things that we could have at home, especially those of us that live in a Lyme area or we spend a lot of time outside with our kiddos?
So I think, yeah, having a good set of tweezers. In fact, they make these ones that have a little magnifying glass attached to specifically really for ticks because they're so small. Ticks are about the size of a poppy seed. So even mm-hmm. if you saw a tick on you, it would be very easy to mistake it as a little fleck of dirt. So that's great to keep on hand. There's actually a special tool. And of course, I'm going to forget the name of it. And I should have kept one in front of me, but it basically, it's a little plastic thing that if you see a tick, it's got, it almost looks like the back of a hammer with a split piece of metal, and you slide it in the tick and you start twisting. And what it does is it kind of unscrews the tick. So it'll pull the tick out without leaving little tick bits in. And it's the safest, easy way. So in the event that you do find a tick on you or your child, you want to save the tick. Don't throw it out. Also, if you have trouble getting the tick out, just be very gentle. Even if you have tweezers, just keep tugging gently. Don't yank it out. You don't want to rip it out. Eventually, the tick will let go, and sometimes it takes time. Don't do the old thing that your mother or grandmother told you. Don't burn the tick. Don't put Vaseline. Don't put essential oils on it. All it does is it scares the tick, and it's the likelihood the tick's going to inject more of its stuff into you, which we don't want. Mm-hmm. But take that tick, put in a little Ziploc baggie. You can put a little damp cotton ball just to keep the tick kind of fresh. And then there's a place called tickreport.com. You can just go online, fill out the form, mail your tick in, and then 72 hours later, it'll give you a report of whether it has Lyme, Bartonella, Babesia. So it's good to know if the thing that just bit you is carrying something. If you see a tick on you and it's not attached, you don't have to worry about it. Ticks, once they have a meal, they're bigger and then they fall off you. They don't stay on you. So if you see a tick on you and it's not attached, you can pull it off safely and just discard it and you're fine. Beyond that, I also recommend if you live in a Lyme endemic area to buy some permethrin. Permethrin is very toxic when it's wet, but it's very safe when it's dry. Research shows if you spray your shoes and socks with permethrin, so go outside, wear a mask, gloves, or get someone else to do it. Get a pair of dedicated shoes and socks that are your outdoor shoes and socks, spray both, let them dry, and it reduces the risk of getting a tick bite by more than 70%. It's huge. So this is something that anyone should be doing, particularly if you spend a lot of time outdoors. You know, beyond that, having a little first aid kit, I'm not in the camp of everyone who gets bit by a tick needs homeopathic Leadum. I think that's a gross misuse.
That is one of my biggest pet peeves. Thank you for saying that.
I know. Someone's like, oh, I read you got to take Leadum. I'm like, no, that's not really how it works. And Leadum really doesn't generally do much for people with Lyme patients anyway. So you don't have to have homeopathic Leadum, but, you know, have, you know, clean off the area if you get bit by a tick just well with soap and water. That's all you need to do. You don't have to go crazy with it. if there's a concern that you got bit by a tick, because knowing there's going to be some time, I do recommend, you know, to keep some herbs on hand. The herbs you can take very safely, they're not going to harm you in any way. And in the event that Lyme is there, there's a good chance you can get ahead of it while you're waiting to get the information. You know, once you get bit by a tick, it could take 3 to 4 weeks for you to make antibodies. So testing you right away doesn't make sense. We usually wait at least, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to do a blood test on you. Again, you can send the tick off if you know you got bit by a tick, and see what that carries. But using something like, you know, cat's claw, I use cat's claw, Banderol, and Kumanda. There's a company called Nutramedics that makes these three products. They're tinctures. And again, you can do drop doses of it. I talk about the specific doses in my book if people are interested, for children and adults. But you can kind of start right away. And if you're on it for 2-3 weeks while you're waiting for this other information to come back, if it comes back positive, okay, I'm just going to stay on that regimen. If it comes back negative, then you just stop, no problem. But I think it just helps reduce the risk of having any kind of persistent problem.
Yeah. I have a specific question because I always see it. I see it more frequently than tweezers. I see mom say, don't use tweezers, scrape it off with a credit card.
No, that's not helpful. A credit card's not going to be sharp enough. And the problem is, if it's really embedded, the likelihood with the credit card is you're just going to shear the head off. If you use tweezers, you can pull the entire tick out. Again, when you start tugging on it, it'll eventually let its jaws go. Again, you might be there for a few minutes, just gently pulling, don't yank, just keep tugging. And usually the tick will come out. What happens is people get impatient, they go, oh, screw it, and they just rip it out. So just be patient with it. But no, don't use credit card, use tweezers.
Yeah. Or we're in our mom panic, which just makes everything crazy and need to happen quickly.
I know, burn it off. Please don't do that. Bad idea.
You know, Dr. Ingalls, I think if you, with all the time that you have with, you know, because you're not busy with doing, seeing all your patients and doing all the work that you're doing in all the different organizations, if you were able to put together a tick and Lyme first aid kit, there would be so many people who would be grateful if you had like the tools and the herbs and like you were able to put it together. If you ever decide to do that, let us know, because
I'm going to make a note right now. That's actually a great idea. And I will work on that.
Yeah, I will buy one from you. Please let me know. I'll be your first purchase. Jody and I will race to be your first purchase. Perfect. All right. So, you know, we come here for interviews and you get business ideas too. So, you know, you've shared with us earlier that one of the many things that you talk about in the book is diet and things related to like food allergies and gut health and how important gut health is. And so we know that people who either have issues with their gut health before, they could become more susceptible to chronic Lyme or PANS, but then also that they have more likelihood of having issues with like food allergies and gut health. And so I know that you could talk about that in your book, but then you also dive in a little bit deeper and you note that you have found that many of the commonly followed diets that you'll see in like social media or in the various communities, like paleo or anti-candida, just don't really help with Lyme. So can you tell us why that is and what you recommend instead?
Yeah. So I recommend what people follow is what's called an alkaline diet. An alkaline diet's not new. It's been around for decades. And the idea behind it is that when you eat food, it breaks down your body. It makes your cells alkaline. It can make them acidic or it can make them neutral. And when you look at cell pH, with the exception of your skin, your stomach, your bladder, and for women, the vaginal area, which are very acidic to help protect against outside invaders, the rest of your body is more or less alkaline. So the idea is that if we can have you eating foods that keep you in the right cellular pH, the cell's going to function the way it's supposed to. It's going to repair more efficiently. And when you look at the research on alkaline diet, we know it's an anti-inflammatory diet. We know it improves blood flow. It helps with bone health. It actually reduces risk of MS. So there's a lot of benefit to this. And I think if you go back to our true paleo forefathers, this is probably the way they ate. You know, we killed when we could, but it probably wasn't a daily thing. So we were still foraged off the land. So we probably ate mostly a plant-based diet with some animal protein. And that's kind of what this is. So the way I break it down in my book is sort of in three categories. In category one, these are foods that are very alkaline forming, and it has nothing to do with the pH of the food. Like lemon juice, lime juice is very acidic. If I squeeze it on pH paper, it'll churn acid. But when you drink lemon juice, it breaks down your body and makes you very alkaline. So Category one is mostly plants. You'll see it's a lot of vegetables. There's some nuts and seeds and legumes and a handful of grains. Those you can eat as much as you like. They're all very alkaline forming. Category two are foods that people can eat, but I recommend to keep probably down to 25% of your intake. That's all animal protein and a lot of fruit. So the best way to think of category two is if you divide your plate into quarters, it shouldn't fill up more than a quarter of your plate. And then category three are their foods that are very acid forming. It's a lot of junk food, processed food, dairy products, coffee's on there. And you know, if you really want to know how you're doing, if you get some pH paper at the pharmacy about 30 to 60 minutes after you eat, go pee on the strip, and we want to see your urine pH 7.2 or higher. If you're in that range, we know that what you're doing with your diet is keeping you in that alkaline state. So it's a good, really just easy, inexpensive way between all the supplements you take and your diet. You know, are we keeping you metabolically in that right range to, you know, do what we want to do with the diet?
Yeah. All right. So obviously we talked a lot about your book recommending diet and functional medicine and herbal approach to help healing with Lyme. And as you said early on in our conversation, that you have a lot of respect for homeopathy in your practice, and that homeopathy is really what you credit your ultimate recovery with. And I know that you use homeopathy in your practice too. Where do you see homeopathy playing a really big role in healing Lyme?
Well, again, you know, it's an entire system of medicine unto itself. So what the beauty of homeopathy is, it's not just one symptom targeted. It's mm-hmm. dealing with the totality of your physical, mental, emotional, spiritual well-being. So we take this collection of symptoms. I mean, for me, you know, I was given APIS. Why? All my symptoms were left-sided. I have these burning sensations. I had red, swollen stuff on the left, which is very much an APIS characteristic. So it was unique to my symptom presentation. Mm-hmm. And I will say everybody with Lyme, again, has a unique symptom presentation. Although there's a lot of overlap, there's also a lot of things that are unique to the person. So, you know, I was always taught in homeopathy that, you know, you got to look beyond just the superficial symptoms. Yeah. And I'm very much a miasmatic prescriber. So I try and look at the miasma of the person, look at the miasma of the remedy, and see if the two fit. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to give a very psoriatic person a syphilitic remedy and so forth. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's one of the tools in the toolbox. It's not the only tool I use. But at some point, I'm usually using some element of homeopathy with people. And whether we start that sooner or later kind of depends on where people are at, what they're comfortable with. I find for a lot of people, homeopathy is still very new to them. Yeah. What little experience they have is, you know, some other friend told them to go buy a Boiron over the counter for a cold or teething or whatever it is. And so they know it's a bunch of sugar pills, but beyond that, they don't really understand. So the idea that you can give, you know, a magic sugar pill and induce this profound change seems a little odd for people. And sometimes it just takes a little bit more education for folks to understand, you know, this is what we're trying to accomplish with it.
And we're doing our part to try and educate people with that. And we're the PANS community understands a lot more about homeopathy, thanks to the work that we're doing. And then also more so, not even just us, but the parents and talking to each other and communicating yeah. and sharing their experiences and their stories. And like in, you know, I'll throw in where I think it really plays a role, because I do think that there is a role for all of the stuff that you've talked about. And there's usually like one little piece that just like, it doesn't like, it's like the thing that brings everything together in a lot of cases too, right? It's like that one little thing. And ultimately it's again, homeopathy really addresses that susceptibility that so we can hopefully prevent relapses for people in the future as well. So we can do all the work to clean things up, get the bugs under control, and then homeopathy can like deal with the kindling so we don't catch fire again.
Yeah. And, you know, and I have some people that are so hypersensitive, they've tried the herbs, they've tried the and they just don't tolerate it. Well, that's the beauty of homeopathy, is that pretty much anybody can tolerate it. You can find the right potency, the right remedy that you can apply to potentially anyone. So when people like, I've tried everything, I can't tolerate anything, I'm like, great, let's just do homeopathy. Let's keep it simple. And in many ways, it's almost better, because that's the only variable. Yeah. You know, the only thing we've done is given a single constitutional remedy. Now we can see very clearly how that's impacting, because often we're mixing homeopathy with other things. And, you know, my teacher, again, she was a purist. It's like, no, you only do homeopathy, you don't do anything else. I'm like, I get that, but I practice a little bit differently. But for people, again, who have that level of sensitivity, this can be a great option.
Yeah.
I got the $1 million mom question here. can you ever completely eliminate Lyme? And does its presence mean that there's always going to be a problem?
So we don't have any evidence that Lyme can be completely eradicated. But the truth is we don't know because we can't measure it. We don't have a test that tells us whether it's completely gone. Do I have people who are symptom-free? Yes. Does that mean it's gone? Who knows? I'm of the opinion, I don't think so. I don't think you get rid of it because I've seen people who've been symptom-free, they go through some horrible stressor in life and they become symptomatic again. I think of it kind of like shingles. You can get chicken pox as a child and then your immune system gets stressed and taxed and you get shingles 40, 50 years well after the fact. It's the same virus that's been in your body for 40, 50 years. I think Lyme can become opportunistic when the circumstances are right. So I don't know that we ever completely eliminated 100%, but we can definitely get to a point where you live with it, it lives with you, and you don't bother each other.
And that's another place that homeopathy comes in really helpful, is because if it's not necessarily something you can completely eliminate, if you can reduce your susceptibility and your reactivity to it, it can really make a huge difference for your overall well-being and recovery.
Yeah.
So you mentioned several really actually quite detailed. I was surprised how detailed you went with some of your protocols in your book. When is it really important that somebody reach out to work with a professional to help guide them?
Well, I think ideally, probably as soon as possible, only in that it's so, the terrain is so complex. There's so many nuances of Lyme treatment. Lyme can go sideways in a hurry. And although I recognize there are people who live in parts of the country where there aren't really Lyme literate practitioners that don't understand those nuances. But I think, you know, what we learned in the pandemic is that a lot of us work remotely. We work, you know, through telemedicine. So there are opportunities to connect with someone who understands it better than others. So if you can get in the hands of a local practitioner, that's ideal. If not, you know, people like myself, and there's a lot of us out there now that can potentially help remotely.
And have you found that any of your recommendations change when Lyme is one of many triggers for PANS?
Not necessarily. I mean, if we identify that Lyme is one of the triggers, again, I guess I should say that it's kind of unusual that there's one trigger. I think it's a building up of multiple triggers. Now, one trigger may be more profound than the other, but once you become hypersensitive, you know, you could be hypersensitive to mold, hypersensitive to food. And I see this a lot after people get exposed to Lyme, where they had no sensitivities at all. After Lyme, now everything in their world bothers them: food, perfume, chemicals, mold. And even if we're effective at getting Lyme under control, often we have to go back and kind of clean up the immune system and often desensitize them against whatever these triggers are. So, you know, from the PANS world, if we identify Lyme, you know, we'll target that, particularly with something like LDI, and try and help downregulate that immune response to the Lyme organism.
Well, Dr. Ingles, I'm so grateful for the time that you've given us and the expertise that you've shared with us. We have definitely done a deep dive, and I'm hopeful that we asked all of the questions that our PANS community would like to have asked about Lyme for a Lyme expert. So if anybody's listening and there are things that we missed, let us know, and we will hunt Dr. Ingles down. I know how to get a hold of him to get the answers for you. How can people get in touch with you if they would like to connect with you?
Sure. Easiest way is just through my website. It's just DarrenInglesND.com.
Right. And we'll make sure we put a link to that in the show notes today. I just appreciate that we got a little bit of a taste of some of the environmental expertise that you bring as well. And I might be reaching out to you to see if we can talk you into coming in again another time to talk to us about the environmental aspect, because it is such an important role, sure, whether it's Lyme or other triggers that we're dealing with PANS. But I will follow up with you at another time about that. I'm not going to put you on the spot here. Thank you so much for your time and your generosity and sharing your expertise. And if anybody wants to get the book, it is a really fantastic resource for Lyme. And just so you guys know, it is available on Audible as well as in hard copy and Kindle. So it's a place that you can, not the place that you can read, because many Lyme people can't read very, like they just don't have that capacity, right? You've got a lot of opportunities to get it in different formats. So we'll make sure you got all the links and everything that you need to get in touch with Dr. Ingles and get more information about him and all of his expertise. Thank you again for joining us. Take care, everybody.
Bye, guys.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for pans and pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.